I, Brett M. Kavanaugh, do solemnly swear.
I, Brett M. Kavanaugh, do solemnly swear.
That I will administer.
Brett Kavanaugh was sworn into his lifetime seat on the Supreme Court 29 days before the coming midterm elections. It's already been an election defined by enthusiasm among women, as voters and as candidates. So how has Kavanaugh's confirmation impacted things? One of the people we've been talking to in trying to understand this moment is Kelly Dittmars of the Center for Women in American Politics. Kelly is co-author of A Seat at the Table, Congresswomen's Perspective on Why Their Presence Matters. So, Kelly, what do you know about how the Kavanaugh battle has influenced things so far?
For women, it's energizing on both sides. So among the Democratic progressive women that were already mobilized around a sense of imbalance of power between men and women, this just further reinforced the idea that the Republican Party is not a party that listens to women's voices. But on the flip side, there are certainly Republican women who really came out in defense of Brett Kavanaugh and were almost energized in that defense and in the defense of the president. And so you could also see it sort of raising their attention towards voting in November.
Certainly watching Twitter, every few minutes somebody was like, here's what you can do with this anger. Give your money to this candidate. Give your money to this part of the campaign. So what does that money mean with just 28 days left? Why is that money important?
So we run these really long campaigns, but the reality is the majority of the public isn't paying attention until the last minute. And there are decay effects in advertising. In other words, you know, it stops having an effect after a week or 2 weeks. And so in this case, the ability to raise high amounts of money in the final weeks of the campaign allows you to put out your message more directly to voters and across platforms. You're trying to persuade some voters, but more than anything, you're trying to just be sure that your base voters, the voters who identify and affiliate with your beliefs, are going to turn out at the ballot box on November 6th.
And so it's on. We are 4 weeks out from Election Day, and the battle lines are starkly drawn. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety, Gender, Power, and the Midterm Elections. And in this episode, we're asking, why does it even matter? Okay, yes, there's a historic number of women running for office right now. But does the gender of those candidates tell us anything about what kind of political leaders they will be? We're going to start with one race where a woman is running as an underdog and has, in fact, been an unexpectedly strong fundraiser even before Kavanaugh. Kathleen Williams is running as a Democrat from Montana's one at-large congressional seat.
I'm Kathleen Williams. I'm running for U.S. Congress. We need to turn this thing around.
She was a total upset in the primary, and now she's steadily gaining ground on the Republican incumbent, Greg Gianforte. Now, that name may sound familiar. It's because he made headlines last year when, before he won a special election in Montana, he body slammed a reporter.
Sick and tired of you guys. The last time you came here, you did the same thing. Get the hell out of here.
Jesus.
Get the hell out of here.
Williams may become part of this historic class of women this year. But you know, Montana long ago made history for women in politics. Over 100 years ago, Montana elected the first ever congresswoman, Jeanette Rankin. Now, Montana never elected another woman to Congress after that. Kathleen Williams would be the second ever. But the question we're asking in this episode is, how did Jeanette Rankin do it? Yes, she was white and her family had some money, but how did she actually get voted in 4 years before women got the vote nationally? And what can her story tell us about women fighting for political power today? Women like Kathleen Williams. Our reporter, Mara Silvers, was born and raised in Montana. She has our story.
Who was the first woman elected to Congress?
Elizabeth Rankin. It's a Jennifer. No, what was her name?
You're so close.
Close. Oh.
Who was the first woman elected to Congress in the country?
Jeanette Rankin.
Jeanette Rankin.
Jeanette Rankin.
Jeanette Rankin.
Jeanette Rankin. Jeanette Rankin.
You know that off the top of your head? Nice. What else do you know about her?
She was a woman's hero.
When I was growing up, I always heard Jeanette Rankin talked about as this legend, someone that the whole state should be proud of. But I never really understood her backstory. How did she go from the sprawling plains and rugged mountains out west to the halls of Congress? I went back to Montana to find out more about this woman I'd always heard about.
I'm on a dirt road, as you can probably hear, and I haven't seen another car in a while.
One of my first stops, this spot between the Missouri River and a mountain range called the North Big Belts.
I don't have any service out here. Oh, there's somebody.
The home that Jeanette Rankin grew up in isn't around anymore, but she spent a lot of summers up here. The family's old ranch home is nestled at the entrance to a rocky mountain gulch.
Hey. Hey, is the Rankin Ranch up this way?
Yeah, this should probably be them.
Okay, great. Then I'll just walk around a little bit.
Right, you by yourself?
Yeah.
Watch for snakes?
Yeah, all right.
Montana is still a wild place, and it makes sense to me that this is where she came from. The landscape is rugged. It's intense. It makes me feel adventurous. It's a trait that Rankin showed throughout her whole life.
There's this tiny dirt road that I'm on, and it goes in between these cliffs.
Jeanette Rankin was the oldest child in a big family, and they were pretty well off. But at the beginning of the 20th century in rural Montana, there weren't a lot of opportunities for young women. Rankin got restless. She didn't want to be stuck in a small town, running the house, taking care of family. So when she was in her 20s, she left. She went to a place where young, ambitious people have gone for a long time.
The metropolis of the Western world. A romantic panorama of towering spires and massive structures. A great city.
Rankin arrived in New York City in 1908. She studied social work, and she spent a lot of time in Greenwich Village, where she was not the most radical lady on the block. This is where anarchist Emma Goldman and birth control advocate Margaret Sanger were making history around the same time that Rankin arrived. The village was a hotbed for political activism. And it's where Rankin fell in with a crowd of women who challenged her politically and socially.
Not just lesbians, but free love lesbians, socialism,
anarchists.
These women show up in her life from then on.
Rankin biographers Jim Lopatch and Jean Lakowski. I met them in their living room in Missoula, Montana.
But how exciting for her, you know, she to encounter women who were accomplished and making their own way financially.
The women in Greenwich Village became Rankin's lifelong friends. And according to decades worth of Rankin's personal letters, some may have also been her lovers.
I think that the most logical, and I think it's responsible, conclusion is that Jeanette Rankin was either bisexual or lesbian.
Now, Rankin was very private about her personal relationship, so there's still a lot that historians are debating. But she never settled down with a man or a woman. She never had kids. It seems like New York City was where she started to see a future for herself as an independent, political woman. And this kind of feminism was a big idea in the early 1900s.
The first feminist movement in the late 19th century and the early 20th century must have been just a deliriously wonderful time for her and other women who had ambitions.
Historian Lillian Faderman.
Jeanette Rankin became an adult at a very heady period for women who wanted independence and saw themselves as more than the domestic creatures that many women were consigned to during the Victorian era.
Rankin and her friends were invested in making social reform, with women taking the lead. They said society's problems could only be fixed if women held elected office and started making policy. And the first step toward taking political power was getting women the vote. After she earned her social work degree, Rankin burst onto the suffrage scene, and she quickly earned a reputation as one of the best campaigners in the whole country. Here's one part of a speech she gave in 1911.
Men want women in the home, and they want them to make it perfect. Yet how can they make it so if they have no control of the influences of the home?
Rankin campaigned all over the country, and when she had an audience, she made an impact. She wore stylish dresses, and she had a striking figure. She was just captivating to watch. One newspaper article described her as having a kind of luminous quality when she spoke. But what really made an impression were Rankin's ideas.
It is beautiful and right that a mother should nurse her child through typhoid fever. But it is also beautiful and right that she should have a voice in regulating the milk supply from which the typhoid resulted.
Eventually, Rankin brought her new campaigning skills back to conservative Montana. And she was careful in her suffrage speeches. She didn't want to come off as too radical. Her friend and fellow suffragist Mary O'Neill told her to be strategic.
All the dope you can about the influence of women in behalf of the children and appeal to the higher standard of motherhood and truer home life. That's the gush that gets the public. That kind of speech, that'll do more to make suffragists than all the purely intellectual guff that we might give them in a whole 100 years.
Rankin might have been dulling down her message, but that didn't mean she was boring.
She was in Lewistown speaking, and she came out in something like a gold
leopard print outfit. She was outfit. Quite the dresser.
And they said that she just was mesmerizing, compelling.
Rankin's other strength was being willing to cover a lot of ground on the campaign trail. And that's saying something. Montana is the fourth largest state, and in 1910, there were about 2 people per square mile. But by 1914, all of her road trips and street corner speeches paid off. Montana gave non-Native American women the vote. Native Americans wouldn't get the vote until they became U.S. citizens 10 years later. So this was how Rankin ended up running for Congress. Campaigning for suffrage was her gateway, her launch pad. Montanans knew her, women could vote for her. Her brother Wellington, a lawyer, funded and managed her whole campaign. And in 1916, she did it. She won her seat by a landslide. But electing a woman to Congress wasn't immediately headline news. The morning after the election, Jeanette Rankin said she called up the local papers herself.
And I said, how did Jeanette Rankin run? And the newspaper said, oh, she lost.
Rankin gave this interview in 1963 when she was in her 80s. And you can still hear how much she enjoys telling her victory story.
And along about 10 or 11 o'clock, Wellington telephoned. He was in Helena and I was in Missoula, that I had won. And so when the women came in to sympathize, we said, and I said, but I had won. I really had won.
Rankin said the Montana papers didn't admit she'd won for another 2 days.
Well, now they knew from the beginning that I had won. Mm-hmm. Now, why did the newspapers say I hadn't all that time, except for wishful thinking?
The election was international news. The United States had its first ever congresswoman. And after she took office, letters to Rankin from women started pouring in. Having a female representative created this window into so many women's lives. They wrote to her about factory conditions, problems on their farms, about having sick children, and the fear of having their sons drafted into war. One woman wrote to Rankin with a desperate plea for help.
In the correspondence is a very poorly written, long, handwritten letter from a woman named Jessie Nakin, who in her letter describes being an abused wife.
Mary Murphy is a professor of history and philosophy at Montana State University. When she found this letter, she was stunned. Nakin told Rankin about her whole marriage, and in 1917, that was unheard of.
She was very happy to marry this man who seemed wonderful, and on her wedding night, he took away her pocketbook because he said she had no need for her own money.
He did not swear at me till 5 months after we were married. I told him I believed I was in a family way. Oh, how he cursed at me and said he supposed I would be sickly and he would have to spend on me.
And she then just chronicles a progression of verbal abuse, of physical abuse, of cutting her off from the community.
and he knew all I knew of married life was what he told me, so he used me rough for 6 years of our married life. I had to let him, 14 to 20 times a week. I could not stand it. I got poor, weighing around 100 pounds.
And she figures out how to write to Rankin and ask for help.
But Murphy says the country's first congresswoman didn't have many answers.
You know, Rankin, what could she have told her to do? I mean, we didn't even have the concept of domestic abuse. A man had a right to his wife's body. She did not have any viable economic choices. There was no such thing as a shelter for abused women.
Rankin didn't get to be an advocate for women for very long. She was outspoken and radical, but she was also unpopular. In 1917, just days into her first term, Rankin was one of the few members of Congress to vote against World War I, and her critics tore her apart. They said that she was weak, that she couldn't vote like a man. But the real blow came when Rankin got on the bad side of the biggest corporation in Montana.
She stood up and defied the Anaconda Copper Mining Company.
More than 160 men died in a mining disaster in Butte, Montana. The workers went on strike, and Rankin sided with them. But going up against the Anaconda Company was a dangerous move.
Over the course of the early part of the 20th century, they take control of practically all the newspapers in the state. They control employment, they control the economy, they have a very strong role in politics.
Rankin pressed President Wilson to start an investigation into the accident. She also called for the government ownership of metal mines, and the company did not like that.
It's the political kiss of death.
The Anaconda Company pressured the state legislature to gerrymander Rankin out of her seat. Lawmakers even had a slogan, "Do you want to keep a woman in Congress?" Rankin lost her bid for re-election after her first term. But 20 years later, she ran again on a pacifist platform, and she won. In 1941, a day after Pearl Harbor, Rankin was the only member of Congress to vote against World War II. And once again, she was politically sidelined.
Coming up, what's going on with Montana today? So, Mara, Jeanette Rankin, she gets to Congress, and she stakes out these unpopular positions, right? I mean, she takes on World War I, and she's talking about the labor conditions under the copper barons back in Montana. And so those stances lead her to losing political leverage.
Right. So some of the people who celebrate Rankin say that the way she acted in her first term was almost sacrificial. She wasn't willing to seriously compromise on these major topics, and it cost her her career.
See, and that begs the question, I mean, how effective was she as a legislator?
The historians that I spoke to said not very. I mean, she didn't have any major legislation passed, although she did get the ball rolling on some maternal and child welfare bills that passed later on. But other people argue that her meaning is actually symbolic. And it seems like Rankin knew that at the time. She realized that it mattered, the stances that the first woman took on war and labor. Now, that's not to say that Rankin didn't have her flaws. She used racist rhetoric when she was campaigning for suffrage in conservative areas, and she lived off of her brother's money, even though he treated his workers poorly. Plus, the people who knew her said that she was notoriously headstrong and difficult to work with. And yet, she was willing to stand up for the people of her state. And I think that this is the kind of politicians that a lot of Montanans still yearn for. So many people there still see her as a legend.
She's like the original nasty woman.
I spoke to Betsy Mulligan-Daig. She's the director of the Jeanette Rankin Peace Center in Missoula, Montana.
What else do you think about when you think about her?
She showed up, you know, and she had great courage in not listening to the voices that were trying to tell her to play it safe. She was willing to stand by her conscience, even though it cost her.
Okay, but if she's so symbolic and is still widely revered for that symbolism, why has Montana not sent another woman to Congress since then?
I think that the easiest answer to that is that Montana has changed a lot since Rankin's time. When she was campaigning, she centered her gender as one of her strengths, that because she was a woman, she had this valuable perspective that could be used in politics. And that's an argument that a lot of men aren't buying anymore. When I brought up the fact that she was the last female representative for the state, most men that I talked to were ambivalent.
There's plenty of women in office. Maybe Montana is just yet to get the right woman that is going to represent Montana views and values.
Like with the whole Hillary thing and all of that, I don't believe women should run for that kind of position of power.
Why not?
They're either going to be too power hungry to prove themselves, or they're going to be too weak and soft hearted, I think.
But most women had a different response.
That's really depressing. I've never thought about it in those terms. That's horrific.
That's not cool. What the hell's up with that?
How do you feel about that?
I think it's a load of dookie, and I hope that we elect one to Congress this year.
So you're a supporter of Kathleen Williams, I assume?
I am.
Williams isn't the first progressive woman to run for this seat since Rankin. Women ran in the 1970s, the early 2000s, and even in 2016. But Williams and her supporters say that this year could be the year.
Good. Hey, Kathleen.
Hey there.
Mara Silvers.
Nice to meet you, Mara.
Nice to meet you, too. Thanks for...
I met Williams and her campaign staff at the Montana Folk Festival in Butte. She was wearing a long green summer dress, and it was really hot outside. But Williams was walking all over town, talking to voters the whole time.
Okay. Get the job done in November.
Oh, yeah, it's going to take all of us.
Yes.
So tell your friends.
You got me.
Your bowling league, golf buddies, poker group. Yeah.
Williams was an underdog in the Democratic primary this spring. She raised a lot less money than either of the male frontrunners. But she won partly by doing what Rankin did a century ago, driving all over the state to campaign in tiny towns and far-out districts. She's been telling voters she's competent, experienced, and ready to take on the chaos of Washington.
Congress can't pass a budget. Washington is dysfunctional. Greg Gianforte does not represent us. There is a need. I have the ability, so I've stepped up.
Montana is a fairly red state, even though it has a Democratic governor and a history of Democratic senators. It went 20 points for Trump in 2016. Gianforte, Williams' opponent, is a tech entrepreneur, a millionaire, one of the wealthiest members of Congress. And he has a reputation for having a short fuse. If he's defeated, it would be a huge political upset. But voters in Butte seemed excited about that possibility.
You met Kathleen Williams? She's running for Congress.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi there.
I'm Bob Henry.
Hi, Bob. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, I'm running against Gianforte.
I know that.
Okay.
I'm going to vote for you, too.
Thank you so much.
Good job. I could tell who you are.
Oh, good.
Keep up the good work. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
You kick his butt. Yeah. Please, please, please.
Need everyone's help.
Oh,
right?
You got it. You got
tell
it.
Your friends.
Williams can come off as a little reserved, but she has a kind of quiet force. It's a kind of political willpower that I would like to imagine Rankin would respect. And Williams is working hard to get out the vote. After she won the primary, a local paper published an article with a photograph from her campaign. She's down on the ground, and it's the middle of winter. She's putting snow chains on her tires so she can keep trekking across the state. And when it comes to Rankin, Williams doesn't shy away from the occasional hat tip.
And I'll leave you with this. It's been over 100 years, and Jeanette Rankin deserves a successor. Join us!
The fact that this Montana seat is even in play kind of says it all about this political moment. It's still leaning Republican, but right now, it's on the map. And if Kathleen Williams flips it for Democrats, she will almost certainly be part of a record-breaking class of women coming into Congress. But Jeanette Rankin's story got me thinking. What if we filled all 435 seats in Congress with women? Would it change anything about gender equity in America? There's this really, really old debate in social justice circles, a sort of tension between ideology and identity. Does one matter more than the other? If we want racial justice, don't we need more leaders who are people of color? If we want gender equity, don't we first and foremost need more women in leadership roles? Put simply, does gender matter? And if so, how? I asked two really smart women to tackle this massive question. They're both Democrats, both coming at this from the left. And I'm going to get out of the way and just let them go at it. So here's a conversation between Daily News columnist Alexis Grinnell and Fordham University political scientist Christina Greer.
So just voting for women for women's sake puts you on a road that can be a dangerous road, just because I think we've seen time and time again where, you know, I always talk to my students about descriptive versus substantive representation. So yes, I think it is really important for young people to see female electeds and mayors, senators, members of the House, governors, you name it, president one day. However, we have seen enough women be terrible. I would much rather a forward-thinking male representative than some regressive woman.
Like, women are just people. And
yes,
we're trying to make up for a huge deficit in representation. We have, like, a huge body of research that when women are in power, in government, in politics, that they do tend to advocate in advance for issues previously not sort of on men's radar.
Right.
Women tend to focus more on education, issues relating to childcare, et cetera.
So they, paid leave. Like, and we also know that Black electeds, right, when Black people are elected, they tend to care about issues that disproportionately affect people of color. So the descriptive representation is real.
Right.
And it's sometimes, but not all the time, tacks onto substantive representation.
Right. And so the point being, I guess, is that we need more women in office. One, because, again, in a representative democracy, women should...
We should
have more women. That's argument enough.
We shouldn't be 51% of the population have 20 U.S. senators. Like, that's ridiculous.
That's ridiculous.
But I do think we also need to bring up, right, like, not all women behave the same way. And
right.
So we see, when we say women, it's just this wide brush. And for someone who works on Black politics, it's like, well, no, right now, Black women are the keepers of the Democratic Party and democracy. White women are the ones who have been and continue to uphold patriarchy in a lot of ways.
All sorts of ways.
At the ballot box. So I think we also have to be a little more intentional sometimes when we
yes.
talk about the power of women making either progressive politics or big D Democratic politics happen. It's just like, well, when we disaggregate those numbers, we see that it hasn't necessarily been white women who have been on that agenda. It's as we've increased the number of women of color who are in the political sphere as voters, as electeds, or whatever it may be, that's also pushing a leftist agenda.
Totally. But the substantive representation also, I want to disaggregate from this sort of essentialist narrative. So, like, it's very popular right now, every time some scandal-scarred man flames out of politics, to be like,
we need more women!
We need more women now! And it's like, what is true is women don't have the same kind of problems that men have in office. Like, right, women are unlikely to whip out their genitals and
right.
walk around in a bathrobe. And Dana Nessel, who's running for Attorney General of Michigan, cut a hilarious, fabulous ad where said, right, she was like, I will never wear a bathrobe to work. I will never show my penis to someone.
That doesn't mean that women won't uphold patriarchy, because if
exactly.
anyone has ever looked at American history or read Mark Twain for five pages, you know that, like, white women have been the keepers of patriarchy
right.
in
so,
a long,
so this is my
in a
problem.
Very, very long speech.
I say let's elect more women, but not because I expect women to necessarily behave better than men. Well, so women, we know this from social science research, that when women decide to pursue high office, typically they sort of want to do it because they want to change something. There's some policy issue they care deeply about. It's oftentimes a decision that comes to them, like, later in life, perhaps, where they're like, you know, I never thought I would do this, but damn it, I got so angry about blah, 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 I'm running for office now.
Which is why this moment is so unique and interesting, because after 2016, you see the age diversity of women who are like,
right.
you know what, this is disgusting, and I'm so frustrated having this particular person either in the White House or the...
Right.
governor's house or whatever it may be, like, I'm actually going to get off the sidelines.
Right. And so women tend to, you know, get worked up about something, pursue office to do something. We know men typically run for office because they want to be someone.
Mm-hmm. That anecdote that a lot of politicians or politicos use, where it's, you know, you tell the female candidate, you know, it's like, well, we've done your preliminary polling and it looks like, you know, only 40% of people are behind you. And it's like, well, maybe I should sit this one out. You know, maybe I should go back and like think about why I really want to run and, you know, research some more issues. And then you tell the male candidate, it's like, well, we did your, you know, preliminary polling. And it looks like 2% of people. It's like, great. So like, when do we get started? And it's like, wow. But I think, you know, that's obviously a much larger conversation about society and how from a very young age we
consistently condition men to see themselves as leaders. Well, so here's the thing about the data about this. Women are more collaborative ideas. So the electorate is more willing to vote women into legislative bodies, not into executive positions.
Not into executive positions.
But legislative bodies because, and this is a little bit chicken the egg, I think this collaborative idea suits voters who understand women as nurturing, this motherly kind of role. And it that bias works in women's favor because it also gets them elected to legislative offices because they can stand up and say, look, I'm going to work with people. I'm going to get things done. I've been on my PTA forever. You know, come on.
Right.
That was Alexis Grinnell and Christina Greer. Greer is a professor of political science at Fordham University and the author of Black Ethnics. Grinnell is the co-founder of Pythia Public Affairs. She also writes a column in the Daily News about gender and politics. If you have been enjoying this podcast, and I hope you have, then please do us a favor. Go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening and give us a rating, give us a review, get offline, go tell your friends. Everything you do to tell folks about it will help us a bunch. Thanks a lot. United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios in the newsroom of WNYC. This episode was reported by Mara Silvers. It was edited by Christopher Wirth. Casey Means is our technical director. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Our intern is Allison Light. She also did dramatic readings in this episode, along with Karen Filman and Audrey Quinn. Andy Lancet is our archivist, and special thanks to the Montana Historical Society for providing the Jeanette Rankin audio. Our team also includes Amanda Aronchik, Christopher Johnson, Jessica Miller, Kari Pitkin, Belinda Siriwardana, Courtney Stein, and Vera Lynn Williams. Karen Filman is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is vice president of news for WNYC. And I'm Kai Wright. Thanks for listening. United States of Anxiety is supported in part by the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Additional support for WNYC's election coverage is provided by Emerson Collective, the New York Community Trust, and New York Public Radio trustee, Dr. Mary White.